Well met, and welcome to episode 145 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for February the 12th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we take a break from our discussion of Pericles for a special interview. Now, if you've been in Southern California in the summertime, and you're a Shakespeare fan, and really, if you're not, why are you even listening to this? You've undoubtedly heard of the Independent Shakespeare Company and their free shows in Los Angeles's Griffith Park. Well, last week, I had the opportunity to sit down with the founders, Melissa Chalsma and David Melville, in their LA Studio HQ performance space, and they were kind enough to carve out some time for an interview. And the conversation was so wide-ranging that I'm going to have to chop it up into three parts. And today, you get to hear the first part. But first, a mea culpa. I took my bare-bones recording rig down to LA, in other words, the iPad and the Blue Yeti microphone. Now, the mic's pretty damn sensitive, so any move of, or it seems around, the table on which I place the mic gives us some soft thudding sounds. So I apologize for that. Next time I'm taking the full rig, boom mic stand, the whole bit. What I cannot apologize for, however, are the sounds of the LA Metro trains rumbling nearby. Man, those trains are loud. Well, anyway, without further ado, here's the first part of my conversation with Melissa Chalsma and David Melville, the artistic director and managing director, respectively, of the Independent Shakespeare Company. Today, I am happy to be with David Melville and Melissa Chalsma from the Independent Shakespeare Company in Los Angeles, California. So thank you very much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And for the people who may not be in Southern California, tell us a little bit about Independent Shakespeare and its evolution.
Well, we started, how long have we been doing this now? Since 1998 we started in New York. Melissa and I met doing a production of Hamlet that was on Broadway with Ralph Fiennes playing Hamlet. And I was in the English company that came out. Melissa was one of the American actresses that joined us. And that's how we met, and we got married, and we ended up living in New York, and we started putting on plays, and then...
I think like a lot of actors, we were chronically underemployed, and we spent a lot of time complaining about why we weren't getting jobs or how we weren't getting jobs, and then it was kind of a group of us at the time who had either pretty much been to school together one way or another, or were friends of friends, and we sort of got together and just started putting on plays because no one else was hiring us, more or less, really. And then it just took off from there, and we found that we really liked producing, and that's how it started.
So what is it about producing that you enjoyed?
I think I liked being in control, really. I liked having more authority as an actor. Actors typically in theater, you enter into a process after a whole set of decisions have already been made. So a lot of doors are already shut in the creative process, typically, for theater performers. You come in and maybe the design has already been designed, the set's been designed, the costumes have been designed. Oftentimes the director has started doing blocking, or a choreographer started doing the choreography, or has completed it even. And so you have a little slice kind of this creative piece. And what can happen is sometimes that works really beautifully because the people around you are amazing artists and know more than you do. And it's just a terrific thing to be part of that. And then sometimes the opposite happens. And for me, really, what struck me, the difference between self-producing plays that probably if we went back and looked, I don't know that we'd be embarrassed. They were very youthful and enthusiastic, and something about them was you know, engaging and interesting. But, you know, they certainly weren't hopefully we've learned something in 20 years of producing, and they've become better productions. But the difference for me was, you know, I was in a production, and the director just insisted on putting this underscoring under this, you know, this critical speech in my performance. And I had this, I really had to argue this. And I said, but this is telling the audience what to feel. And that's my job in this moment. Right now, this is my job. Because it was, and it wasn't just that I was being a diva, which I'm sure I was. I'm sure I'm a chronic diva. David could ask that question.
No, not at all.
Not what? What? Well, you know, women get called divas. Men get called, you know, self-assured. So I'm very self-assured, let's say that. But it was really this moment in the play that was the actor's moment. And I had, you know, I got the music delayed by about a line. And every night I'd get to that and the music would come on and I just would want to almost throw up because it was such, I thought, such a terrible creative choice. Now, some people can say that's not an actor's job, but I thought, well, I want it to be my job. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be in this position anymore. And so I think for me, that was when what I really enjoyed initially about producing was being able to have much more creative control over the projects I was involved in and the people I was involved with. And so that was what I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and the whole idea behind Independent Shakespeare Company was to put a certain philosophy into practice that we had a theory about, but, you know, we'd never tried before. And that was to really empower actors. And part of the idea was to go back to the limitations that faced Shakespeare when he was producing, because he didn't have all the modern trappings of a modern theatre. He didn't have lights that you could manipulate. He didn't have artificial sound. He didn't have elaborate scenery and all the things that we use to in a way disengage people's imaginations. His principal, you know, tool that he had were his actors. And so we wanted to see what happened if we really... There goes the train.
Is it on time?
It's the 12:37. that was the idea behind it. And it felt like a very independent way of doing it. And that's why we called it the company that. And I think that if we did look at those productions that we did all those years ago, that I think the spirit was really clear mm-hmm. back then of what we were doing. That's what really Absolutely. Caught people's imagination. It was different and it was fresh and it really, you know, it actually worked. That when you had a group of people that were really empowered because they were presenting their own work on stage rather than trying to figure out the vision of a director, that spirit carried through and it was infectious and much more immediate experience. And I think that even though we've evolved and we have, you know, we still have a very small budget, but it's massively more than we started with.
Our first play was $800
yeah.
we spent on it.
So, I think that the spirit is still there and we forget about it because now sometimes it feels like we're running a small regional theatre or something. But, you know, there's a philosophy still behind the company and it sometimes when we meet people from the more traditional world of producing theatre, we butt heads with them because they can't get their head around the way that we want to work, and we're very stubborn about it, and sometimes there's fireworks.
Now, I think that's right about the idea about it being a spirit, because I think we used to, you know, because we do have recorded sound now, and we do have, you know, we do sometimes use some of those things that we were
so... We break our rules.
We were sure we had found the secret. But I think ultimately it does come down to that idea of how do you take people in a room or on a stage in a park, including the audience too. How do you take a group of artists and audience and give them the space to have the most creative, exuberant opportunity? And so I suppose for me, because I actually do a lot of directing now... I like to think I have a vision, but I don't know. But hopefully my vision is mostly about how do we create a really exuberant creative experience for the artists and for the audience, that they feel like there's a part for them too in the production. I think sometimes you go to see a play and you don't feel, as an audience member, it's kind of almost like you don't feel you're a part of it. You don't feel your presence there is needed, your presence there is demanded. And we really try to make sure the audience knows not only are they welcome, they're needed. And without them, this production won't happen and won't work. So I think ultimately that spirit has stayed very, very true, regardless of changing circumstances or you know, we go down these several years long pursuing this one way of doing it and then changing course and doing it a different way. But I think that spirit has always been the through line. So I think that's a good word for it.
Another train. You know, you use the term exuberant, and that's something that I expect when I come and see the plays in Griffith Park now, especially the, if not the breakage of the fourth wall, the actual disintegration of the entire building. I mean, you know, being within the audience and doing portions of the show. Is that part of the actor empowering spirit, or is that something that's grown off of it at a later date?
I think that's something that's very intrinsically Shakespearean. Mm-hmm. They were exploring that in those plays. I mean, there was that Night of the Burning Pestle, which isn't by Shakespeare, but one of his contemporaries. The play starts with the actors on stage and then someone in the audience heckling them, saying, "I can do it better." And they say, "Well, get up here and give it a go." So they were very interested in exploring the relationship of what theatre meant to the audience and how you could blur those lines.
There may not have been lines to blur yet.
Yeah, they didn't.
Think that had been done yet.
Yeah.
But that came much later, I think, at least in Western theatre, that idea of that the audience and the actors are somehow separate. Because in Shakespeare plays, characters speak to the audience and refer to the theater that they're actually in. And they're all really, really, I mean, just in general, are pretty anachronistic in that way.
It's interesting, though, when you see much Shakespeare that's done, those speeches to the audience become very much, you know, internalized and made usually more serious than they need to be. And it's just refreshing during the summer to be able to go to Griffith Park and have that interaction. You know, we're not a part of the play, but it makes us feel like we are.
Well, you are a part of the play. And in those soliloquies, it's very deliberately. I mean, we're not doing something perverse. I mean, they're actually written to be a dialogue with the audience. I mean, that's how they're intended to be performed. It's very scary to actually do that.
In fact, that's true, because sometimes one of the things we talk about is that, you know, especially in Griffith Park, because it's daylight for much of the play. You know, usually as an actor, right, you can not look at the audience. You can kind of pretend they're not there. Or in your mind, you can have the idealized audience that's really hanging on your every word or something. But you have to really confront the audience. And I think it is scary scary for me, let alone someone who's never had to do it before. And so sometimes we almost want to push that to really make ourselves really confront the idea. Yes, there are really people here. And they're judging you, or they're not judging, you know, they're not even paying attention to you, or they're reading, you know, and it's really,
well,
I think,
sometimes they respond to you.
And sometimes they
respond
to you.
Because a lot
yeah.
of these soliloquies are questions to the audience, you know, what should I do? You know, and sometimes they'll give you an answer. Sometimes they'll chime in, like, to be or not to be. Sometimes they'll finish. Which isn't always great, but those are the rules that we've established there, that there's that the spirit of freedom.
Do you ever have actors come in who aren't prepared for that and kind of freak out?
Yes.
Do they freak out during the rehearsal process or when they first get out there in front of an audience usually?
It becomes clear who can handle that and who can't.
Or who wants to.
Who wants
it's
to,
It's more
yeah.
than who wants to. Because I think it's really is a question of, as an actor, you know, what is it you have an appetite for? So some of us have an appetite for that. But other actors who are very fine actors don't have an appetite for that. And they do things that probably I wouldn't be very good at because I'm not really interested in that aspect of it. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think that does become pretty apparent. I think you're right in rehearsal.
Yeah, I mean, we require people to have a very different relationship with the audience, not just during the play. I mean, they're not required to.
They sign a contract in blood.
But, you know, the audience are very present. We see them, you know, we'll bump into them as they're coming up and taking their seats. We encourage the actors to, you know, if they feel like an intermission, go out on stage where they're selling T-shirts and things and mm-hmm. chat to people. Often people have brought families and kids that have questions and some of the actors will be happy to go and talk to them or, you know, just, you know, create a community in that way, which, you know, I've never really experienced in other theatres, and it's very meaningful to the audience. It's one of the things that keeps them coming back. So, sorry, that's Pickles, our dog, who will be starring in Two Gentlemen of Verona this summer.
I might have to let Pickles in here.
Yeah.
Now, you had mentioned something that I hadn't heard yet, and that's that Two Gentlemen of Verona is going to be one of the plays.
Yeah.
How far in advance do you choose the plays that you're going to put on, and what's the decision process like for choosing those plays?
We usually, for the summer season, for the Griffith Park Festival, we, by the end of one season, we typically know what the next season is going to be, so that we've gotten into the habit of announcing it on closing night to the audience. So sometime over the summer, which is we usually pick it.
Well, we try. We have something usually pinned up on the wall. We have like a 3-year plan of plays, but that shifts and changes. So we don't necessarily stick to it, but it's an idea of where we're going. I mean, it's a combination of trying to reach plays that we haven't done before. And then coming back to plays that we haven't visited for a while. I mean, it's in the summer, it's a balancing act of trying to have one of those sort of really big star comedies, or a Hamlet or a Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet or something like that, that's going to anchor the season. And then maybe something that you can take slightly more of a risk. So our season this year is Two Gentlemen of Verona, which isn't necessarily one of the great comedies, but it's definitely a crowd pleaser. And then Measure for Measure, which is, I guess known as one of the problem plays, although it's a brilliant play.
It's a great play. I think one of the ways we, or at least how I think about the plays, I won't speak for you, but is to also think about, I get very, sometimes very interested in finding plays that fit performers. So because we do tend to work with people, as you know, from seeing the shows, you see some of the same people, you know, some season upon season, or, you know, someone comes back who hasn't been there in a few years. So we do try to kind of, we like to, it's not we try to, we just enjoy working with a group of really like a like-minded artist collective, really more than anything. And so for me, sometimes I'm also thinking about actors that fit a role, or actor, you know, I think Two Gentlemen of Verona, sort of, especially last summer, we kind of looked at the group and thought, this is we have a really good cast for this play. They have all the skills that could make this production really great. And production this summer is going to have live music and swing dancing. And we sort of happen to have a group of people that have those skills, you know, enough people that it kind of makes me really excited to work on a play like that. So that's sometimes it. Or, you know, in case Richard III, which we did last summer, that's a project David's been wanting to do for a long time, this particular kind of version of Richard III, and work on that play. So that was just kind of, well, this is the year that we have to really pursue this kind of story that you were really interested in. But I do think we do like to kind of, we don't pick plays absent thinking about performers. The plays aren't plays that then we find performers for. The performers are part of that process, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because we do have a company.
Now, speaking of last season and Richard III, I had also seen earlier in the year in Pasadena the Othello. And what was it like to play like two of the great villains almost back to back?
That's right, you did.
I know.
You went right from Iago into Richard III.
It was the year of the villains, wasn't it? And there was Stefano, the slightly villainous drunken butler in Tempest. It was tremendous fun. I loved playing Iago. I mean, it was the second time I did it, so it was really fun to come back to that. And then Richard was just glorious and was one of the highlights of my acting career, I think. You know, they have their similarities. They're also sort of very different. I mean, Richard is much more active in his villainy, in that, you know, he participates. And Iago's, you know, it's all about suggestion, you know, creating doubt and that kind of subtlety. And I tried to find two very different archetypes to have in my head for who they were. Well, the thing about Richard is he's an actor, so he's whoever he needs to be in that particular situation to make it happen. So he says he will change colors like the chameleon, and you find that playing that every, you know, a persona is just a tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Iago, I tried to find, I wanted people to believe that people could believe him. I tried to find the most innocuous voice and comforting presence in my head when I was approaching it. And the first time I did it, our son was driving along. We had a CD of someone reading the Winnie the Pooh, and it was what's his name? Alan Bennett. Do you know Alan Bennett? He's a famous playwright in Britain. He was also part of the Beyond the Fringe group, you know, with Dudley Moore and Peter Scott, mm-hmm. Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller. Alan Bennett is, you know, he's from Yorkshire, and he's got this very comforting way of talking that's just very soothing, and you couldn't possibly believe, you know, he's such a cuddly, nice. So I thought, well, what if Iago actually, you know, sounded like that, and was that, you know, comforting? And I think that approach hopefully makes him even more villainous, because it's very treacherous then, that people are absolutely taken in by him. So, you know, Iago does it. It's an act throughout the whole play that doesn't reveal his true self until the end. But Richard III's, you know, he's pulling on different personas left and right. And then, you know, at the end of every scene stops to, you know, reveal himself to the audience. And you know, it's Richard III's a much earlier play. So, you know, it has a sort of two-dimensionality that Iago doesn't have so much.
It's also much, I think, much more political. The world is much different. I mean, Othello is very much a domestic play amongst a group of people that is unique to that group of people at that time. Mm-hmm. Whereas Richard III is almost, in some ways, a satire of every corrupt government that's ever been, you know, whether it's a school board or whether it's a nation. I think that's one of the ways we were talking about it last summer. And I think that idea that there are people that ally with Richard because of what they want and their own agendas and so on. Whereas in Othello, nobody has a secret agenda except for Iago.
Right.
Everybody else is just behaving, you know, are upstanding people. Whereas in Richard III, there's a lot of people that are, you know they're making a deal that's, you know, with somebody who's not so great.
You know, it's interesting that you use the word satire, because last year's production was the funniest version I had ever seen, but the laughs were uncomfortable at times. I mean, like going into intermission, you know, the stuff about, you know, building the wall to keep the Scots out. I mean, you laugh at it and then you sit and go, we're in California and this is like kind of real for us. And, you know, and then it was the summer and,
well, back then it was a joke. Yeah, back then,
I know exactly.
You know, there was a moment in that when the Lord Mayor was trying to gee the crowd up, and you know, so we get the audience to start chanting "Richard, Richard," and they all gleefully go along with it. And I always think that really is a snapshot of how fascism works. You know, everyone's okay, let's cheer for that guy. And there were some people in the audience that got very upset at that moment. They're going, no, I won't cheer for him. I'm not going to. I see what's happening, and the audience would become quite divided that way. It was, you know, great to be part of that.
And then some nights, by the end of the play, though, they would really be cheering for Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
Which was very, I mean, I always found that very exciting too. Of course, when he died, and when our son said "boo," and that's his only, that he always says, "Did you hear me boo, Daddy? I booed when you died."
At least I have one person,
one fan, one supporter.
Well, somebody's got to love Richard. Come on. Again, thanks to Melissa and David for carving out some time from their busy schedules to discuss the history of the company and the philosophy they used. Now, be on the lookout. Or would that be listen out for part two of this interview, in which you'll hear more about the summer season as well as their iambic lab.
Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who are asking for bigger, poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this year's website. Okay, time for a little shameless self-promotion here. Last month I mentioned in the podcast, and I definitely mentioned it on the blog, that I'm acting as dramaturg and Antonio, that's Leonardo's older brother, in the Camarillo Skyway Playhouse production of Much Ado About Nothing. We are now ending our second of 5 weekends, and it's been a blast thus far. There are some truly wonderful moments in this production. Solid performances, thoughtful direction, great costumes. Who could ask for anything more? So the show will be running the rest of February, Friday and Saturday nights, and Sunday matinees, ending the first weekend of March, when, as a birthday gift to myself, I'm going to shave the mutton chops I've grown for the role. But to see those mutton chops, if you're in the Ventura County neighborhood, check out Much Ado About Nothing at the Camarillo Skyway Playhouse. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on subjects, including some tiring questions, video review, Pericles, BBC 1984, let's do the time and space warps again, opening night, Pericles, protagonist, dumb, showy, meta, the geography of Pericles, infographic. Pericles, back to the Ephesus. Pericles, pageantry? And Pericles, marina. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page or our Twitter feed. Remember, however, that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast, when we'll wrap up Pericles. Hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for February the 12th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.